We've been talking about aspiration, vow, resolve, intention, motivation, determination, commitment, vow. All these words, slightly different implications, but they all have some sense of some, like, direction into the future. So some of us have been questioning that. If our practice is about completely manifesting this each moment, does such a thing as aspiration seem like extra and almost steering us off track from right here? I think this is a great question to explore when looking at bodhicitta from all different angles. One thought came to mind is that there is the teaching in Buddha's way that all actions of body, speech, and mind are based on intention. In Abhidharma, it's like Buddhist psychology, it said that intention is one of these so-called like universal dharmas. It's like, it said that every mind moment, maybe even dreams, every conscious mind moment comes along with some intention, cetana. So from that point of view, if everything we do constantly all day long, whether we're aware of it or not, is based on some intention, conscious or unconscious intention, then we can't avoid having an intention. It may be that Buddhas actually have somehow gone beyond any kind of personal intention. For us, it's always operating. So there's a teaching that there's always an intention, and often we're not aware of it. So even if we're just presently engaged in the wholehearted activity of the moment, there is some intention behind it. So therefore, just to follow this thread out, since we have an intention every moment, even so-called spontaneous moments, what about looking at bodhicitta or arousing the aspiration as just like deeply studying the intention of the moment, seeing and by being aware of that intention, letting it shift in this wholesome, compassionate, enlightened direction?
Because, you know, you're whatever. I suffer a lot from that. say to myself, as soon as I start that kind of yearning, just cut it off. Say, if I don't want, I intend. In other words, if I have something, if there's something in my life and I have an intention about it, then good. I'm gonna, you know, I'm not just gonna sit. So I'm asking you then, okay, you said there's always intention. I'm wondering, sometimes I think there's wanting without intention.
In that example, we might look at the time, it might be that the intention is not to like go and get what we want, but there may be some other intention that if we look deeper, maybe it's quite subtle. But if, you know, if I understand that teaching correctly, it would be that in that mind moment of desire, for example, there's some underlying intention that might be even unrelated to the wanting. It might be the, you know, I really want this, but actually there's a mental intention to distract myself from the present moment, for example. Not consciously, but, and maybe the desire arises unconsciously based on this underlying unconscious intention to somehow avoid the boredom of this moment. So a desire arises. For example, you know, it could be that there's no intention to act on this desire, but maybe there's this very subtle intention of just like, I can't stand not wanting anything. Maybe this happens in Zazen, right? We're just really at peace, and the mind starts to get uncomfortable with not wanting anything, so it arouses some desire.
I'm talking about obsessive kind of wanting.
Yeah, but just in this example, I would say that there could be... I would propose that there is some underlying intention that could be related or unrelated to the desire. And that if there is some kind of intention every moment, especially when we're actually doing something with body and speech, which may be a little different than your example, then to look at practice examining that intention and shaping it in this way we might call bodhicitta. May this intention, be a beneficial one for all beings. So it's like a mind training thing to, since we always have intention, to like cultivate the intention in a certain direction. That's just another way that arose of thinking about bodhicitta and aspiration in particular, as opposed to the big project of like, now I will generate the aspiration for supreme enlightenment. That's maybe we sometimes have some reservations about that because it sounds so kind of contrived and too big and not dealing with the simple reality of the moment. But the simple reality of the moment includes some intention. So maybe just a little shift. And I think that, you know, we have these mindfulness verses, for example, that could be done in a clunky, contrived way, but it could be just a little thought of like, you know, washing the face. Now as I wash the face, may all beings enter the pure, spotless Dharma gate and be completely undefiled. So it's like just doing this mundane activity with the intention to just clean the face, and then also adding in this little shift of like, oh, as I wash the face, may all beings be, you know, free from greed, hate, and delusion, free from suffering. Maybe that sounds a little bigger than just slightly shifting our intention. But I think there's ways, practices like that could be like, not seem like such a big deal, but they're training the mind in this direction. Another way I thought about intention since this morning was refuge in Buddha. Sometimes it's spoken of that taking refuge is one practice and then arousing bodhicitta is another, and they're often they go together, but they're two different practices. And the thought arose, maybe we could see them as not that different. Taking refuge in Buddha, relying on placing our trust and our life direction towards Buddha. This is like taking refuge. In Japanese, it's kiei, which literally means return to and rely on. So I return to and rely on Buddha. It's an intention, right? It's just an intention. And if we think of Buddha in this case as the awakened mind and the fully compassionate mind that wants to free all beings from suffering, which I would say that is Buddha, right? If we take refuge in that, it's virtually identical to bodhicitta, seems to me. And then we have this verse. We have verses that go with the three refuges called the three refuge prostration verse that we do like on the full moon precepts ceremony, and it's done at other times also. And it comes from the Flower Ornament Sutra, where there's all these verses shifting the mind towards this compassionate intention for all beings. So our translation, we say, I take refuge in Buddha before all beings, immersing body and mind deeply in the way, awakening to mind. So awakening to mind in Japanese in this verse is Hotsu Mujo I. And I is almost the same as Shin. It's like, it's got the same mind radical in there, but it means like thought or will or intention or mind, actually. It translates manas, the Sanskrit manas. So virtually the same, I think, as Hotsu Mujo Shin, the title of this. So in that verse, Ji Kie Butsu, I return to and rely on Buddha. Togan Shujo is, my understanding is this really like, it's a may all beings, it's a wish. Gan is like vow or wish. Wishing, vowing, wishing or praying, or intending that all beings embody the great way or immerse body in the great way and awaken the unsurpassed mind or arouse the unsurpassed mind. So in our tradition, taking refuge in Buddha goes along with this wish that all beings arouse the unsurpassed mind, including us. The way we see it is before all beings. It's kind of more, it's more about ourselves in our translation. I like saying may all beings, including us, because it kind of like, it's a compassionate wish, may everyone take refuge in awakenedness like this. I take refuge in Buddha. As I take refuge in Buddha, may all beings embody the great way and arouse unsurpassed mind. So therefore, almost like taking refuge is a form of arousing unsurpassed mind, arousing bodhicitta. Yes.
So are you saying that because intention is in the Abhidharma system, that you believe it or that it is?
Just because it's there?
Just because it's there.
I'm like, yeah, that's a good question, right? I generally am like, consider myself very much like in accord with the tradition. I haven't always been that way. It's like over the years and years of studying Dharma and seeing more and more deeply how it accords with my own experience. I trust it more and more, and I see there's so much wisdom in so many of these teachings. Sometimes I might have some doubts or questions. In fact, in some of the Abhidharma stuff, where they say that actually the world is not spherical, but it's like, you know, pie-shaped or something. I have questions about it. I think, well, maybe this is symbolic. But a lot of the way that the mind works, and especially this is like kind of pretty basic Abhidharma, all the different schools agree that Chaitanya is a so-called universal Dharma. And the more I like it, so I hear that, I hear these, you know, these three kinds of wisdom, right? The wisdom from hearing, like, oh, I understand what that means. I don't know if I agree with it or not. It's this wisdom from hearing. It's a kind of wisdom, even if it's just hearing something diluted, clarifying the words, and then the wisdom from reflecting on, which is like checking it out in one's own experience. And like, oh yeah, actually that makes sense. Or no, that actually really doesn't make sense to me, is a kind of further investigation of Dharma. And then the wisdom that comes from actually directly realizing something. So I'd say I haven't directly realized this in every mind moment, seeing the intention. It may be hard to do, but from reflecting on and, you know, looking at mind moments and my understanding of what intention is, it's almost like, for me, that teaching's almost like a common sense one. It doesn't require a lot of, like, there's no kind of metaphysical underpinnings, I don't think. It's just saying, if you look carefully, you see that every time you're doing something, there's an intention. So I'm kind of talking to you, and I picked up the paper and put it down, and like, was there an intention to do that? I would say, yeah. And if I'm really paying attention, I can feel it. I'm actually like aware that even while I'm also intending to say these words, there's this, it's quite complex, right? There's another intention at the same time, or we could say part of the same overall shape of the mind intention is there was the decision to kind of pick up the paper and put it down. So so in a way I do believe it in the world of conventional teachings. Ultimately, of course, none of this is true.
Because every morning we chant the negation of the Abhidharma system.
Well, that's why I say ultimately none of this is true, hey. Mm-hmm. But
what is the Abhidharma system?
Like, you know, this Buddhist psychology, we might say, like the breakdown of the mind into all these dharmas, which are, dharma in this case means like phenomena, mental phenomena. So as Hannah's saying, the Heart Sutra goes through all these lists and says, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no. It doesn't maybe list intention in the Heart Sutra, but it would if it could.
Trying to be succinct.
Yeah, it was summarizing. I think every dharma is empty, means there's no, ultimately no dharmas. So yeah, we have to always specify which level we're talking from, conventional or ultimate. And that's why we've talked about this some already. This Sashin, I think, is good as we get into Dogen. Which perspective is he coming from? He switches back and forth, because he's trying to help us play with these two truths.
So I've always had to leave before the Dogen part started. So could I get to have a little Dogen before I leave in 15 minutes?
Sure.
To go make dinner?
Sure.
I'm not saying the other stuff isn't great, it's just all these other bodhisattvas get to stay around and listen.
Yeah.
But I have to leave.
Let you know that we haven't gotten to it yet.
Oh. I've gotten a few sentences.
Hey, I'd love to hear your...
Oh, we're not there yet.
Hear you expound about this juicy little thing.
Is Dogen better? Maybe. At least we have it here.
You just brought it up. You said Dogen. I went, Dogen.
Dogen, yeah. Arousing the aspiration for the unsurpassable. So, we heard that the eminent ancestor of India, Shakyamuni Buddha, said the snow mountains are like great nirvana. And the Bodhidharma said mind is like wood and stone. What is called mind here is the mind that is thusness. And this is a little wordplay because the word like is called nyo in Japanese. So just like in English, it means like or as. And also thus Just like in English, we say, you know, this paper's like this. We say, it's thus. We maybe don't exactly say synonym, but you know what I mean? In English, the word like or as if, is very related to the word thus. And same with in Japanese. So, mind is like wood or stone. It literally means like mind, like, nyo, wood and stone. Or mind, thus wood and stone. But you usually read it, mind is like wood and stone. But then Dogen's playing with this and says, what is called mind here is the mind like. Or you could translate it as, what is called here is mind is like. From mind is like wood and stone. But you could also translate it as mind that is thusness or suchness. So it's a wordplay that you can't really do in English. So Kaz used thusness. What is called mind here is the mind of suchness. You know, suchness is like actually like a technical term, right, in Buddhism that means basically emptiness. It means emptiness.
Not so, things as they are.
Things as they are, but things as they are is that they're empty. So, briefly defining, it's a synonym for empty of any true existence is how things are thus. So, it's that mind, the mind of suchness, the mind of the entire earth, the mind of self and other, the mind of Buddha ancestors in the 10 directions, the mind of heavenly dragons and the mind of other beings are like wood and stone. There is no mind other than this. So, mind of wood and stone is the mind of suchness, the mind of things as it is, as Suzuki Roshi would say when questioned about his broken English. No, it's things as they are. He would say, no, things as it is.
Mm-hmm.
The mind of wood and stone.
That our consciousness. It's not our consciousness. Things resonate. So when you're not making up a story about them, and some process prior to making up a story appears, and then the stone itself is there. That's how you can understand it. That's how you can move
the stone. Be
how you can read someone else's mind, read so called.
Yeah, the stone beyond all our ideas of stone is the suchness of the stone.
The quality of the stone appears, and it has almost some satisfaction in being able to express itself because you're here.
That's the that's the joy of the dance of the appearing world. Is, you could say, everything is expressing that joy to just appear like this. Like this means such.
So the consciousness is there. If one is to speak of consciousness in some way which isn't strictly neural. I am speaking more widely.
Yeah, we could even say that the any stone or wood that we know is consciousness's version of wood and stone.
So I don't want to try to second guess the other thing. I'm more trying to express what I'm feeling. It's an intellectual construct. And it seems to me that when he's speaking in this about the wood, the mind as wood and stone and time,
yeah,
it's very similar to that line.
Definitely. I wouldn't have thought of that line as connected, but all things coming forth and confirming the self or themselves is awakening. I would say that is the mind of suchness, the mind of wood and stone. Yeah. And that reminds me of Bhajan, when he talks about this mind of wood and stone. Remember, he's the one who said Shakyamuni Buddha talked about the snow mountains, and Bodhidharma said mind like wood or stone. So he seemed to be, Bhajan seemed to be into this wood and stone mind. So he, somebody asks him, how can one attain a mind which is like wood or stone in the presence of all situations? Yes?
Taking your attention out of your head and putting it in your heart.
Putting your attention in your heart. That might be another version of this, but this is how he says it. Just understand that the many things do not originate of themselves. All of them come into existence from one's own single mental impulse of imagination, mistakenly clinging to appearances. Which is a little bit similar to what Jerry was saying, but almost like from the flip side. It's saying that the rock as we know it only comes into mind from our imagination of the rock, mistakenly clinging to it as a rock. If you know that mind and objects fundamentally do not contact each other, mind and object, you know, contacting each other means that there's a separation for there to be a contact. If you know that mind and objects fundamentally do not contact each other, you will be set free on the spot. That's a great line. I think this is Zen emerging from mind only. Okay. Each of the various things is in a state of quiescence right where it is. This very place is the site of enlightenment. So rocks, tiles, walls, and pebbles are all in a state of quiescence. They're like, they're nirvanic. Rocks and pebbles, the whole world is actually like this. All of us are in this nirvanic quiescence. We might even call it joyfully expressing themselves. And and when we see that it's not like there's me, this mind contacting these objects out there, that there's no contact of mind and object, which kind of goes against the Abhidharma, which says mind always contacts an object. So this is from the ultimate view. Mind doesn't contact an object. The many things do not originate of themselves. All of them come into existence from one's own single mental impulse of imagination, mistakenly clinging to appearances. If you know that mind and objects fundamentally do not contact each other, you will be set free on the spot. That's how one attains a mind which is like wood or stone in all situations. And we might approach this not imagining external objects by taking our mind from up here where it imagines external objects and putting it in the hara, because the hara doesn't actually imagine external objects.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what I'm saying, getting rid of somehow having attention somewhere else than where we think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This mind of wood and stone that we're kind of warming up to here, the mind of suchness, the mind that doesn't actually contact objects, because there's nothing external to this mind. It's an all-inclusive mind. It's an inconceivable mind. It's an aware bright mind, but it has no reference points, because reference points are all external, in the external world of objects. This mind of wood and stone is not bound to the realms of existence, non-existence, emptiness, or form, as you might imagine. And we could even to take that a little further, you say it's not bound to non-existence because look at all of this. Here we are, like alive. Here's a world, right? This is not non-existent, what's happening here, but it's not bound to existence, because if we look deeper, none of this truly exists in a substantial way we think it does from its own side. It's all mental projection, continuous flow of mental projection. Therefore, this mind of wood and stone is not bound to existence, but it's also not bound to non-existence, emptiness, or form. With the mind of wood and the mind of stone, you arouse the aspiration for enlightenment, practice and actualize realization, because your mind is wood and your mind is stone. And I want to point out that this word aspiration, that's been a kind of a little sticking point for us sometimes, you know, is not really in here. It's arouse bodhicitta. Literally, actually, it's arouse the mind, which is short for the mind of enlightenment. But hoshin, I think that San Francisco Zen Center is called Hoshinji. I sometimes say beginner's mind temple, but I think it might be a loose translation of this hoshin, which means arousing the mind. The beginner's mind, where all possibilities are there. I'm not sure if it's the same ho. Hoshin's a common phrase, arousing the mind. So it doesn't really. So in this case, it's the mind of enlightenment, which is the mind of wood and stones. So there's nothing really about aspiration. I think we're talking about ultimate bodhicitta here. So you, with the mind of wood and stone, you arouse the awakened mind, the completely awakened mind, and practice and actualize realization. This is, you know, Dogen's classic shusho, practice and verification. So it's hoshin shusho. With the mind of wood and stone, you arouse the mind, practice and verify. You could say, because it doesn't really say your, we could actually say, because mind is wood and mind is stone. With the dynamic capacity of the mind of wood and the mind of stone, thinking not thinking is actualized right now. So we maybe have heard many times Dogen's essential art of Zazen. Thinking not thinking, but Shiryo Fu Shiryo Te is, and the point's been made that grammatically translating this accurately is closer to say, think of what doesn't think, or think of that which is not thinking, because it's that te there is pretty sure that's what makes it the an object of the sentence. So Thomas Cleary makes this point strongly, and I actually really appreciate his great conviction in the meaning of this think of not thinking. Think of not thinking. How do you think of not thinking? Non-thinking. So, think of what doesn't think. So this comes from the story of this Yao Shan, one of our Soto Zen ancestors, is sitting zazen, and a monk comes up and says, what are you thinking? What are you thinking about sitting there like an immovable mountain? And it's maybe like, because he primes him with this question, he answers in this way. If he said, what are you doing? He might have said something else, but he said, what are you thinking? So he says, kind of playfully, I'm thinking of what doesn't think. And then the monk asks, well, how? How do you think of what doesn't think? And Yao Shan says, beyond thinking or non-thinking or without thinking. He, Shi, Ryo. So Thomas Cleary and others, I think, also make this point that this is an expression of this actually like technique, a Zen meditation technique called sometimes called turning the light around and shining back. In the Fukan Zazengi, it says, learn the backward step of turning the light around. Our translation says illumining the self, but the original text doesn't really say that. It says, Eko Henjo, turn the light, shine back. It says that. But I think self with a capital S on your, on your true self, on your true being is the meaning in that translation. Turn the light around and shine back. Body and mind of themselves will drop away and your original face will manifest. So this is, and then later in the Fukan Zazengi he says, think of what doesn't think. How do you think of that without thinking? So the proposal is that these are the same practice, and it's a specific practice. We also have this term, turning the light around, in the Xin Xin Ming, the song of the trusting mind. Maybe our translation says, turn the light of awareness around. How does it go? At the moment of turning the light of awareness around, you go beyond appearance and emptiness. So same term. At the moment of turning the light of awareness around, you go beyond, as Dogen says, form and emptiness. So all pointing to the same practice, and a lot could be said about this, and probably will be said more about this. Think of what doesn't think. But because we're in Sesshin, we have a lot of time to practice Zazen, and I've been trying to work with this ever since I saw this on this page here. and here's my understanding of how we might practice like this. I think first we have to be like really settled, like really relaxed and calm. If we're like, if our mind is, in its obsessive mode, sometimes it gets that way in Sesshin, or we're just like totally out somewhere, then I think it's not so much the time. I don't think we have so much chance to do this. I mean, it's available at any moment, right? But I think if we arouse the aspiration to practice thinking of what doesn't think, first we just forget about all that stuff. I don't need to obsess about that. This is Sesshin. This is my chance to forget about all that. Relax into the hara. Let the mind drop into the hara is like first step. Relax. Realize that everything is supporting us to just be here. There's nothing we have to do. Be somewhat, if our body is in raging pain, find a more comfortable way to sit so that we're actually like can really settle and into the present moment where everything is happening. And present, letting go of the past and the future, which is all our obsessions are 99.9% about the past and future. So if we let go of the past and future, the obsessions are basically gone. It's hard, right? Sometimes we can't, but this is our intention. Settle into this present moment. All the senses are open. Where the bird is singing. The temperature is like this. The body on the cushion is like this. Feels like this. All the senses open. The mind, heart open, and just settle into the present. Some might say this is Zazen, this is the end of the story, but I would propose that at this point is when we have the chance to turn the light around and shine back. It's very close. We may be doing it already, but if we look at this as this kind of technique, it's like we're aware of all the sensory field of sight, sound, smells, taste, touch, you know, physical sensations. So the awareness is directed slightly outward, but it's also not obsessed with anything. It's resting in the present, but directed in this relaxed way. It's a very nice way to sit, right? It feels very nice and buoyant. But then we can take this awareness and actually like turn it back. The light that we're talking about, turning the light around, is awareness. Turn the awareness, the light of awareness, that's slightly directed towards sounds in the present and so on, back towards the mind from which the awareness is arising. Or you could say, the awareness itself. See, we're like aware of the object, but now we're becoming aware of awareness. Another way to say it is instead of turning the light around, because these are just metaphors that help point, is tracing back the radiance. One teacher translates this term, ekkō henshō, instead of turning the light around as tracing back the radiance, which means like noticing this awareness that's directed outwards and just withdrawing it back to the source of the awareness. Now this might sound like really like strange and abstract thing to do, but it did to me for a long time too. I feel like how can we do that? It's impossible. How can the mind be aware of itself? But I feel some like warmth around this now that's like, it's not exact, if we get too clunky about it, okay, I'm going to turn the awareness around and shine back now. Ready? 1, 2, 3. It's like we have to be very, really, very gentle. And it's just a sort of opening backwards. We have to be careful that we don't think that the things are out there and the mind is like somehow inside this head or something, or in here, because it has no location. So again, it's just a metaphor to turn it back. But it's a nice metaphor because the outward thing seems really apparent. The awareness is not really inward, but we sometimes say inward to make it clear that it's not outward. Inward is not outward, but it's not actually some located, the mind has no location, right? So we basically open to this awareness that's actually not thinking. We're thinking of that which doesn't think. We're thinking of just the bright, open, clear awareness itself. And we start to sense how it's very spacious. And sometimes when I feel like, I confess, I am not at all an expert at this kind of practice. I'm playing with it. And it's very joyful to play with. And sometimes I have this sense of just a little bit of that reversal, and I'm already kind of relaxed, but the relaxation at that when settling into this big spaciousness is like several notches deeper. It's like this, the body, something happens. It's like it's more relaxing because there's like just to grasp a world is like somewhat physically, there's a little bit of physical tension to just be alive in this world. And this is sort of like dropping off, where mind and object don't contact each other so much, and so the actual body, there's still awareness. There can be like an awareness at the same time of the body, and which is quite relaxed, more relaxed. So, yes.
What they call a jhana?
It may be related. You know, there's all, I mean, Buddha Dharma is this wonderful tradition that has like all these meditative states it talks about. It's like this huge tradition of intricately studying the mind and all sorts of mind states. So the jhanas are like these particular states of kind of withdrawal. But I would say, in this case, no, because I'm not a jhana expert. I don't know if I've ever even been in a jhana, actually. But my understanding of these jhanas is that it's like the sensory world is really shut down. It's a real withdrawal from the external world. And this sounds like that, right? It sounds like it's turning back inward, but at the same time, there's this great openness. It's just that the attention is not on the sensory world anymore, but the senses are still very open, and the approach is from a very open perspective. So I think it's related, but I think this is particularly Mahayana Zen. You find it all, once you have a sense for what this is talking about, you can find this type of teaching all through Chinese and Japanese Zen teachings, including Dogen. And you also find it in Tibetan, particularly Dzogchen tradition. So, because I love ecumenicalism and not being limited to any one tradition, which I think Dogen was fond of this too. He didn't know about Tibetans in Japan, but let me just share with you from the Dzogchen Tibetan teaching a description of this that to me sounds just like this turning the light around and shining back, or thinking of what doesn't think. This is Sokhmi Rinpoche, my Tibetan teacher who I had the great blessing to meet with on this trip in Nepal and attend teachings of his as well. And last year when I was over there, I he's talking about his father's hermitage at Nagi Gompa. His father was one of the great Dzogchen masters of the 20th century. And who came from Tibet and, you know, having to escape the conflicts there, and set up this practice place. It's still there, called Nagi Gompa, and up in the hills over Kathmandu. So Shoho and I were there for a few days last year. On New Year's Eve, actually, we were at Nagi Gompa. Very, very peaceful. It's up in the mountains. There's no electricity. Maybe they had a generator. So it's a little like Tassajara. The road up is much like Tassajara too. And you have a big, big, vast view over the valley. And it's a nunnery now. Small nuns community. And Toku Origin Rinpoche, Sogni Rinpoche's father, his kind of like Dokusan room is on the roof of this maybe three-story little monastery temple. They call it Hermitage. Well, kind of a big hermitage, like they usually are in Tibet. They have the Dokusan rooms are on top of the roof. Maybe we should have thought about that. Do that here. I think maybe it's because you have this big vista. It's a very spacious feeling up there. It's like Dokusan, I mean, where they meet with students, but also the practice room, about the size of this Dokusan room, actually. About the size of this one was quite small. So this is his son, Sogmi Rinpoche, saying, he's 14 years old. I was able to spend a few weeks with my father at his hermitage in Nagi Gompa. Near the end of my stay, he gave me a lesson in experiencing space. I'll never forget that first lesson. I was sitting in my father's private room, this small space with a bed and altar and enough room for 5 or 6 people to sit. You can, nowadays, because he's not alive anymore, it's just like a little meditation room. So we could sit in this room. Very like bright feeling in there, I think, from this amazing being hanging out in there for so long. Half the room was taken up by windows to which the setting sun shone in golden red light. He said, "Look at the area around you with all your senses open, seeing all the objects, feeling all the sensations. Don't block anything. Can you sense that openness, that simple awareness of the things you see and hear and feel?" I nodded. So, just, you know, open awareness, all the senses open, settled and relaxed, not blocking anything is a nice way to say this. Because I think the jhanas almost sound sometimes like they're blocking out sensory data. You want to find a really, really quiet place. It's nice to have quiet here, but I was trying to do this practice earlier when all the kids were playing across the street and really like listening to the sound in a really non-blocked way and just like really, really open to it where it doesn't actually disturb the this kind of space, right? So all the senses open without blocking anything. With the sun setting through the windows overlooking a broad valley, the sheer physical warmth of my father's body, his sweet but penetrating gaze, the feeling of the hard wood floor beneath me, it would have been hard not to be aware of the multitude of phenomena. Sometimes in sesshin, we might start feeling like that. And his gentle advice to experience this awareness openly without judgment was a powerful influence. There was something almost magical about the way he could communicate without words or gesture the possibility of appreciating without judgment all the things I saw, heard, and felt. Then, he said, now, slowly, turn that same awareness to the mind that perceives these things openly. Instead of looking at outer space, look at inner space. So I hear this as the same instruction of turn the light of awareness around, shine it back on the source of mind. Slowly, he says, and sometimes I said, gently, very gently, look back. That would be another way to say it. Gently look with your mind's eye. He demonstrated with his hands, turning his palms outward to demonstrate the way we ordinarily perceive by looking outward, and then turning his palms inward to indicate the mind that perceives. Then he let his hands drop into his lap to demonstrate just letting the whole effort of looking drop to allow whatever happened to happen or not. I think it's a wonderful instruction. This is the mind. We can see how our awareness is directed outwards. Even when we're, usually it's directed outwards and we're really caught up in the outward world, thoughts and ideas, but we're really relaxed. We're just open to the outward world, not so involved, but quite relaxed. But it's still, that's when we can start to notice this awareness being somewhat outward directed and contacting objects and turning around. Back into the tracing the radiance back to the source. Yeah. Lest we get too involved in the like mechanics of the technique or something. Just let go. In that moment, due largely to the certainty and understanding he cultivated over years of practice, I caught a glimpse of inner space, which is wide open and clear, completely beyond concepts or judgments, in which or through which the entire realm of phenomena appear and disappear. It's the source, right, of mind. It's the source of the stream from which everything radiates out and the whole world appears from this. the entire realm of phenomena appear and disappear through this inner space. For a brief second or so, I had a direct experience of what in the Buddhist tradition is known as the essence of mind, or the nature of mind, which is what in the Zen tradition, like the six ancestors constantly saying, you just have to see your nature and you be and become be Buddha. The nature of mind, Buddha nature. A luminous, limitless awareness that's not chopped up into subject and object, self and other, perceiver and perceived. All distinctions between the looker and what was being looked at fell away, and for an instant I experienced a complete lack of separation between everything I felt, saw, smelled, and so on. Senses are still open, and the awareness that saw, smelled, felt. At that moment, even the effort involved in being mindful of something dissolved, and mindfulness became effortless. The clarity, openness, and warmth simply was. So, Buddha nature, or all last year we talked about the mirror-like awareness. It's just another way of talking about the same thing. The empty, clear, spacious, boundless mirror that receives all the reflections and isn't the slightest bit separate from the reflections. It was, as some classic Buddhist texts describe, like waking up in the middle of a dream while still dreaming. I suddenly, unquestionably knew that what I was experiencing was occurring within my own awareness, but it was an experience free from mental, emotional, or physical labels. I had a sensation of immeasurable freedom and possibility, inseparable from the potential to be aware of anything that emerged from that pregnant possibility. Inseparable from the potential to be aware of anything that emerged from that pregnant possibility. In other words, whatever comes now, at that moment we can feel completely unafraid of meeting what comes, because it's coming from this. It's not out there. It wasn't necessarily an extraordinary mystical experience, but rather more like a deep sense of relaxation, like settling into a comfortable chair at the end of a long day. This recognition of the inseparability of awareness from its experience, the awakening in the midst of a dream, was the Buddha's gift to humanity and my father's gift to me. Turning the light. Let's learn the backward step of turning the light of awareness around and shining back. And body and mind of themselves will drop away, and our original face will manifest. Our original face is just the Zen term for this nature of mind. Then Dogen says, if you want such a thing, get to work on such a thing immediately. Or if you want, that's one translation, if you want to attain suchness, this suchness we're talking about, practice suchness without delay. For a while at San Francisco Zen Center, we were saying, if you want such a thing, get to work on such a thing immediately. And I think maybe people didn't like that so much. Get to work.
Well, you could say go fishing.
Go fishing.
Do you know what I mean? Be out in nature, let yourself be. Start to notice.
Let yourself be.
The sunrise. Mm-hmm.
Let yourself be, yeah. So there's this, you know, being aware of everything that's happening. It's almost like a two-step process, I hear this. And I think that's often how a Zazen description ends there. Just be totally open to everything happening. So the proposal here is, it seems like there's a slight it's maybe quite a subtle, gentle second step of already being really open to everything out, but then there's still a little bit of duality, right? There's still a little sense, maybe not much, but then that turning back is like, it's not just finding, kind of pointing to the source of mind, it's actually resting in or as the surface of the mirror. It's being this spacious awareness. And if the slightest movement then to like, got it, then it immediately separates. Or like even wondering, is this it? So starts to disturb it. But then you can warm up to it again and again. And I think there's many ways of talking about it. Zen has this turning the light around, this instruction is, like this. And one time, I think we had like a whole practice period at Tassajara on this theme with Tenshin Roshi. It was what maybe the main theme. So he was proposing this practice and people were struggling so much, and like, including me, like, I feel like I can't do it. It's too tricky. It's too like, it gets too, when I'm trying to do it, my mind gets too tangled up in the technique or something after 3 months of effort. And I said, well, are there other ways to talk about this? And he said, well, of course, there's many ways. And I said, what about just like completely letting go of everything? Is that the same as this turning the light of awareness around? Is that the same of thinking of what doesn't think? He said, yeah, that's the same. What? Why didn't you tell us this 3 months ago?
Yeah.
So I think this is skillful means, right? All these different tools, because we can say, just let go of everything, and we might not notice the subtlety. It's such a general instruction. We might be like, yeah, I'm just all this, let go. There's just sounds coming in. I'm not even, there's no commentary on them. There's just sensation of butt pain coming in. There's no commentary on it. I'll let go. But that's why I think this second little instruction is like a very subtle still holding. It's not like a strong holding. It's just a sense of duality. But completely letting go, I like that. As you can see, it sounds so different than turning the light around. But you can see, you can try it. These are all experiential instructions we're talking about now. So these are things to try out. And another one is just, rest as the mirror that receives all images. They're just different ways of talking about the same thing.
It confuses me only because we spent the whole practice period with Paul talking about what I thought was turning the light around, but we were talking about just paying attention to everything that's your Zen practice, to watch yourself, to watch everything that comes up and then explore it and find out where it is. And I was in a sutra which I don't remember, but it was over said that.
Foundations of Mindfulness Sutra,
yeah,
maybe?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But
I think very similar.
Well, and are there?
Well, I think we can make subtle distinctions. And, in something like a sesshin, maybe there's some room to make subtle distinctions. So we might say that if we take the four foundations of mindfulness, which is a teaching that Buddha taught in the earlier teachings, that he said is the direct path to the complete freedom from suffering, right? So if we trust Buddha, if we trust these teachings, then is that so? Is this the same thing? So I'd say if we take all four foundations, then I would say so. But maybe we often emphasize mindfulness of body and mindfulness of feelings. They come first, and we can't bypass them. This is like essential. This is the resting here as we are, and then becoming also mindful of the mind is the third. Chitta. Sati. And mindfulness of mind. And that's what, but in that sutra it's defined as like different mental qualities. So there's still a kind of split between, there's the awareness that's looking at the different mental qualities. And it's maybe more like in the fourth foundation, mindfulness of dharma. And where we're meditating on the Four Noble Truths, like cessation, that maybe starts to get into this territory that we're talking about here. That's kind of offhand, I would say. I think it's all included, but we have to take all four foundations. And mindful of all of it. And often it might be also a skillful means to be, just have the teaching, like in Zen, we might say, just be totally present and aware, and we don't, you know, maybe don't hear this thing about turning the light around, but if you're just clear and aware for a long, long time, really settled like that, it naturally, this practice and realization dawns on us. It happens. Naturally, actually. And it may be that in just being really mindful of everything that's happening to us all the time is such a great practice to become really, really present and experiencing what is all this going on, actually. That through that mindfulness, we kind of like, despite ourselves, we fall back into this source of awareness.
Well, things do lose their weight, you know, and do fall away as we start to see them, and then maybe we start to be naked awareness.
Yeah.
And we start to be.
Mm-hmm. And I would say that all the, you know, there's so many more like preliminary practices, which I, you know, the whole first day of talking about these conventional bodhicitta practices, I think are all very supportive of this. So to just Zen maybe sometimes maybe has, could be seen as a fault of Zen, is that it goes so much to these ultimate teachings. If we're not already like pretty relaxed and letting go of a lot of general obsession, I think it's not even that useful to hear this kind of thing. So because it's quite subtle, but it could be useful just in the sense that it plants these seeds, and it may be that, well, I'm not actually, forget about this turning the light around, thanks for mentioning it, but actually I'm working on the obsessions today. And then we might be like working on the obsessions and suddenly like, where are they? On the second or third day of sesshin, they seem so huge and overwhelming, but actually I forgot about them right now in this period. And then I'm like, oh, actually I'm like at ease. And I'm like, oh, wait a second, is there? How about turning the light awareness around, shining back? You know, we never know. It might be like, well, I'm going to be working on like this kind of gross defilements for the next like 100 or 200 years.
Well, it's nice to know if you have practical, real, reachable practices that you can do. Not
yeah.
something so esoteric.
Yeah.
You don't even know what to work on. You're sitting there, you don't turn the light on. You know, it's nice. Okay, I can do this, watch me.
I think it's, there's lots of practices like that, being relaxing, being present, letting go of past and future is the basic underlying practice. And then we have, this is kind of like, I would say it's like a technique. Dogen, I think part of Dogen's thing is he's like, the problem with techniques is that like, they're like these little nice little tools you can grasp and get a hold of. And I think Dogen knows that tendency. So instead of saying, okay, you want to hear the essential art of Zazen? Okay, there's these five steps like this, and this is what they mean by this. Instead of doing that, the Zen style is say, you know, he gives you the straightforward teachings of the posture and so on. We're going to chant this tomorrow morning. We can hear it. And then he says, now you're sitting stably and still, now think of what doesn't think. How do you do that? Non-thinking. This is the essential art of Zazen. You say, well, why doesn't he explain it a little bit more? But I think it's the Zen style. It is a technique, I would say. It's a specific instruction. He's not just messing with us.
Paradox.
I mean, it's a poetic way of saying, especially the part thinking of what doesn't think. Because it's not so much that you're doing this with your thinking mind, which is why the monk says, well, how do you think of what doesn't think? And the answer is, well, you don't do it with thought. It's beyond thinking. But I think the reason he says, think of what doesn't think, is because, like I say, the monk prompted him by asking, what are you thinking there? So we could rewrite this to make it simpler. If it's like, what are you doing sitting there? I'm attending to the mind that doesn't think. I'm gently directing awareness back towards the source of thinking, which isn't itself thinking. It's where thinking emerges from. And that's what I'm doing. But it's this kind of poetic style, right? What are you thinking? I'm thinking of not thinking. But it's not really thinking of what doesn't think, right?
What if you just said, I'm not thinking?
We have another story about Yao Shan, the same one who said, think of not thinking. Another time he was sitting there in Zazen, and another monk, maybe the same one, I don't know, came up and said, what are you doing? I think this is what he said. I think he said, it didn't say, what are you thinking? He said, what are you doing? And he said, I'm not doing anything. I'm not doing anything. And the monk said, do any of you remember this story? I'm not doing anything. Well then, if you're not doing anything, then are you just idly sitting? The monk asks. And Yao Shan said, if I were idly sitting, that would be doing something. Right. This is kind of pointing towards what we mean by really not doing anything, right? So if I were idly sitting, that would be doing something. And the monk presses further and says, well, you say you're not doing anything. What is it that you're not doing? What is it that you're not doing? Well, Yao Shan answers, even 10,000 sages couldn't say. It's inconceivable.
This discriminative language just
doesn't reach this true non-doing. Like the mind of wood and stone is another way to say it.
Oh, is that what?
Yeah, mind of wood and stone. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All these things. I mean, we can make distinctions, but here I would propose these are all the same. Non-thinking, thinking of what doesn't think, turning the light around, shining back, the mind of wood and stone, the great Himalaya mountains, are just, mirror-like awareness. And it's just like different pointers at the same exact thing. Now maybe we find that slightly to say, turning the light around and shining back is a little bit like the exercise of the technique. It's more like having turned the light around and shined back, the source that we're now resting in is the mind of wood and stone. But, I don't know if we make a separation between the activity of looking back and the mind that we see. Another problem with this kind of exercise that maybe is obvious but should be just mentioned is that we're looking back, we're so used to when we look for something, seeing it, right? So this is something we're looking back for the mind, right? We're trying to find the mind, but we're not going to see it, right? It's not something that we're going to find or see. This is part of the trick. Our mind is so used to seeing something, looking back, okay, the source of mind is like this. And I even notice when I do this kind of practice, I find I start to create almost like an imagined image of it from these teachings. Like, it's really vast and spacious. It's like, going through the checklist. Yeah, there's no boundaries, but like, But actually, this checklist is a boundary, right? This is kind of defining it. So it's like, it's still part of the approach. But I think we start to feel like it's getting very close, and the very last threads is the mind sort of assessing how it's going. Or checking, is this it? But it's not a thing, right? So that's why so many stories like this in Zen, right? Weka, the second ancestor, comes to Bodhidharma, the first ancestor, and says, my mind is not at ease. Will you please pacify it for me? Will you please help me to put my mind at ease? Be a bodhisattva. Help me be free from the suffering. And because of the setup of that way he worded the question, Bodhidharma says, well, bring me your mind and I'll pacify it for you. Okay, let me get it for you. Well, what did Ahweka say? Like, when I look for my mind, I can't find it. Something like that. And Bodhidharma says, I've pacified it for you. Really, you've pacified it for yourself, but I helped you to not find it. Before you looked for it, you thought maybe you didn't know whether you could find it or not. Now you actually did this exercise, maybe same exercise, look back for the mind, try to find the mind. You can't find it. And yet, that's why it's not existence, because you can't find it. But it's like total, it's awareness every moment. Here it is, aware of what's happening, therefore it's not non-existence.
But we have a problem because we have a brain, we have a limbic system, we have a whole evolutionary story there, and there's fear embedded in there from ancient, you know, that. So in other words, we're living with a certain, if we say, mind, okay, and no mind, okay, but how can you have no brain? Because the brain will do it, it's going to do its thing, you know, so we're talking almost as if we're finding a way to shut her off.
Well, not really, because we're aware.
Awareness doesn't come from the brain.
That's the part of the Buddhist story here, is that the material world doesn't give rise to awareness. It's the opposite, that actually awareness gives rise to the so-called material world, which is kind of unusual perspective. Although some modern physicists are starting to say kind of the same thing. But it's, however we slice it, it's totally radical. So the brain is actually a human construct created by the mind. I mean, again, the Heart Sutra would say no brain, it would if it could. Again, right?
It's not like...
Yeah, of course there's no brain, ultimately speaking. Well, we don't have to go there.
Physics is
they have a different purpose.
It's not just a different purpose. It's been developed with a kind of an exactitude, with clarity of both experiment and mathematics, so that a good deal of its I don't know the exact sense, but I certainly don't apply too much. Value of Buddhism in that regard, in fact, I think. But what I meant to ask about, which is more of a response, physics just raised its
yeah.
What I wanted to ask about is, I too, this turning the light around, I've never quite understood, and I'm really, really grateful to hear your commentary on it and your experience with it, because that's an approach which I think is really important, and I haven't been able. So the immediate question that I wanted to ask was, when you say awareness, initially when I think of awareness, I'm thinking of discursive mind. But it occurred to me sitting here that what's meant is not that, but awareness. What I'm seeing, what I'm hearing, of which the discursive mind, which has this intention to turn it around, is only a small part. Is that correct in your understanding?
Yeah, it's definitely, it's not the discursive mind. So maybe if we're trying to explicate this from the point of view of Abhidharma, like, or at least like to define terms, because I think it's easy to get wishy-washy around these things. That's why I think these teachings are so helpful. Like, what exactly, what aspect of the mind is turning around, and what's it being seen? Because we use mind in this big way. So just offhand, I would say, without getting too involved in this, because some people might find this tedious, but I would propose that it's the sixth consciousness that, which is mental, there's consciousnesses of all the senses, right? And they're all connecting with the different sense objects. And mental consciousness, vijnana, is aware of, it's kind of conjoined with the sense consciousnesses to be aware of the world. And it also, it has a discriminating function and a discursive, like, naming function. The sixth consciousness can do that. And it also has a function where it's just aware of what's happening. So I'd say it's the, when we let the discursiveness go, we direct the sixth consciousness, which is, again, technically, like, it's a dualistic consciousness. We're using a dualistic consciousness that's operating all the time in this way that the dualistic consciousness looks back and basically dissolves into what I would call non-dual awareness, like Buddha nature.
So, once again, because I didn't quite follow your intention, one view that occurs to me from what this awareness is my mentality, which says I want, or I'm aiming to turn the light around.
Yeah.
I'm
you have an aspiration.
I am me here. Mm-hmm. I'm looking outward.
Yeah.
In an extreme case, I'm prisoner inside. I'm looking outward. Yeah. I view it that way because
it's not that extreme. It seems almost constantly like that.
From the point of view, the view exists because others are impressed, have impressions, are aware of you.
Mm-hmm.
But to get back to the point,
yeah.
Which I'd like to understand and know your view. On the one hand, when I think of it, so as I've been thinking of it too much, I feel now, it's mentality. Is it mentality which is aware that I'm here making some effort to turn the light around?
Yeah.
Or does this word awareness, or the light, not refer to that, refer to something much bigger than that? Something that includes the sense impressions that I have as well. That is the totality of my consciousness. Is that the awareness that's being turned around? Or is it my mentality, which is trying to become enlightened?
I think it's the totality, but the totality, again, is what I would call is not the nature of mind here. That this totality is the sixth consciousness that includes awareness of all the senses, and sometimes is decorated with conceptual thinking and intentions, and all that stuff is like playing on the, you know, conjoined with the sixth consciousness, like mind and mental factors. So there's this consciousness, vijnana, and then has these mental factors like intention and greed or hate and all kinds of different mental factors are kind of like, you know, riding along with it. But it's big, but it's not the biggest. Because, but it's what we're using now, both with the intention. First we have the conceptual intention. Yeah, let's try practice and turn the light around. So now that those thoughts are riding on the light. There's the intention, let's turn the light around, is like a little decorated thought on riding on the light. Now here we go, we're turning it around. This is just a, you know, an image, for thinking about this. And then we shine it back to the source, and this, you know, or trace it back to the source, where at some point it's, it becomes less and less tangible, less involved in the external world, until it drops into, or dissolve, you could even say dissolves back into its source, which is this empty awareness called Buddha nature, which it is said that consciousness actually comes forth from this Buddha nature. Sometimes it's said like that. So we can use our thinking mind at the time of actually, I think part of the play with, and let's try it, you know, and see what happens. But when we're doing it, we can see, we can start refining the technique, which we're doing with conceptual thought. How is it? It's like a back like this, what about, but that's the, like, that's not it, because that's, so there's all this kind of like talking to ourself, which is the same consciousness, but part of the art, it's a subtle art, because it's an intention to do a kind of a specific thing, and yet we have to drop away the thinking about it. How do you think of what doesn't think? I'm sorry, you have to do it without thinking. We approach it with thinking, but in the end, that's why it's so difficult, because we like thinking.
One more book, one way of dealing with not thinking is doing.
Doing, just do it.
Just do it.
Just do it.
So you're busy. Now this isn't now.
Mm-hmm.
You're busy to do it. You're focused on
mm-hmm.
chicken.
Yeah. Yeah. Chop wood and carry water.
Yeah.
Just do it. That's a lot of our practice. Is you could say similar kind of thing. If we're really, really just doing any activity, completely become one with our activity, we might say that that's the same thing, actually. Yeah? It's hard to do anything that completely, because there's a, you know, but sometimes very active things for some people are easier than zazen. We get so quiet and our mind just goes wild, right? But if sometimes we're like we're tightrope walking or something, right? It's like you have to be so doing it. If you think about anything, you'll just fall immediately, right? So almost like sometimes intense situations force us into just doing.
Just doing Tai Chi now, I kind of on a regular basis. I do notice that as I have practiced for the last half hour, I haven't had a thought. Well, that's good.
I mean, not a thought at all?
Well,
maybe there's some, like...
Not that I can remember. I have nothing I really hung on to, you know. I mean, my body was was busy.
Just doing.
Doing,
yeah.
Moving.
Sometimes movement is good, because you're paying attention to that. If you have to think about or remember the next movement, then there's some thought.
Well, that's a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But the more comfortable you get with it, let's talk about degrees. There's a lot less construct going on, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not, you know, obsessing about anything.
Yeah.
Just
do it.
Just do it.
So you can, it's something you can try out if you'd like, this, you know, this practice. The mind of wood and stone. Flow. Could be.
The psychological term.
I mean, I don't know all the details about it. If we saw, you know, how it's defined, we could see it's the same thing, but it could be.
Well, for a brain surgeon, for example, it's into a state when doing brain surgery, so that the skill he or she brings to it is exactly met by the requirements of the situation, and it is the most intense, joyful experience.
Yeah, that's part of what flow becomes very, like, joyful, too, right? I think some, you know, if we're talking about actually, like, you know, resting in the nature of mind, maybe the checkpoints, whether it's, you know, dynamic or still or whatever, the checkpoints are, sometimes it said, I'll just stop after this. This has been helpful to me to look at these three qualities that distinguish consciousness, the subtly or gross dualistic consciousness called vijnana, and this spacious awareness called the nature of mind. One is that consciousness is somewhat constricted, and this nature of mind is totally free. Now, you know, we could get into defining these terms, but like you can have some sense of this in your own experience. It's like I feel like I'm dwelling in consciousness pretty much right now, right? And I feel like it's a little bit constricted. You know, my body's a little bit constricted, my mind's a little, it doesn't feel completely like complete release, right? So complete freedom and release is a quality compared to the somewhat constricted. Consciousness is always somewhat constricted. And another quality is consciousness is kind of like limited or bound, has some edges in a way. And this nature of mind is boundless and completely vast, no boundaries at all. You might say, well, what do you mean consciousness has boundaries? Well, you can, in your own experience, see if it feels like there's some edges. and then last, maybe most easiest to see is that consciousness always has reference points. This is in front, this is on the side, this is in back, and I'm me, and you're you, and it might not be that clunky, but some sense of like, you know, in meditation it can quite subtle, like, I'm here, I'm doing the, turning the light around, yeah, the mind is, it's not even me now, but the mind is turning, here it goes. It's like, there's still a whole bunch of reference points there, right? So in this nature of mind, there's no reference points. It's like you can't get a hold of anything. It's completely boundless, spacious, no reference points. And that's why it's so free and at ease, because there's no place to stand. It's the mind of no abode. Which is like maybe a little disturbing to a mind that actually, the consciousness that actually relies on reference points to maintain our sense of identity and the world. I so appreciate practicing with all of you and like all these, you know, heartfelt questions to investigate, like, what is all this? And it's a very lively discussion. So I'll take most of the blame for going on for so long, but like, you're helping me.
I'll take the risk.
Thank you. We offer, in the conventional world where things arise and cease and where a bunch of positive merit, conventionally speaking, is just generated, you can almost like, you feel it, this big ball of it here. It's not, there's no real merit, right? But where there's books and tables and stuff, there's merit, and we take it and wrap it up into a ball and throw it towards all living beings so that they receive it. And it gently touches the tops of their heads and percolates down through their whole bodies and fills them with joy and peace of Dharma. That's one thing you can do with a ball of merit. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.